Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, an internationally renowned filmmaker, an artist, a legend, there's no other way to put it, Bruce LaBruce is here, one of the original people I wanted to have on this podcast. I've been dreaming about having him on this thing for years at this point, and now it has finally happened. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and the guest booker of this fine podcast that you're listening to, Tristan Abraham. Tristan, I love you, buddy. Thank you for all your hard work that you do. And he will get the message to me. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at LeftForDamian. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just telling all your friends about it, just by telling everyone you know about it. You can also support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on your platform that you're listening to it on, or by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And thank you to everyone that does do that and contribute to the show that way. And speaking of supporting the show, this thing would not be possible without the kind, loving support of Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damian, just let us cover some of the costs of this thing. And they have helped me cover the costs of doing this podcast for a few years now. And I really do appreciate that because it allows me to keep doing it. So thank you very much to them for that. Also, check out Flood Magazine to see the latest Punk as Fuck videos. I go to Brian Ray Turcotte's house. And if you're not familiar with Brian Ray Turcotte, he did the book Fucked Up and Photocopied. He's done a few books since then, but he did the books Fucked Up and Photocopied, Volume 1 and 2, and has a punk rock collection that has to be seen to be believed. Like, this is something that should be in a museum. By all rights, should probably be in a museum. But right now it is in a vault. You'll see when you watch the video. It is a fascinating journey. Brian's the coolest. I love Brian very much and played in a bunch of cool punk bands. And anyway, watch that video. And I think that's it. Also, check out some of the episodes we've been doing. We've been putting out so many episodes that I think some are getting kind of lost in the shuffle. There's tons of guests. So if there's someone out there that you're like, oh, I wish they interviewed him on Turn Out a Punk. Well, maybe we haven't, but there's a chance we have. So search through all those 300 some odd plus episodes that are up there, and maybe there's someone that you thought we hadn't interviewed yet. I just say that because I get hit up all the time. People are like, oh, you got to interview this person. That's like, well, that did happen. So check it out. All right. On to today's show. Today on the show is a guest who, well, I've known him just through, running into him around the city of Toronto for years, but known of him for even longer because Bruce LaBruce is a legitimate legend. You may have heard of Bruce LaBruce's films from people like Kurt Cobain talking about him, from cinema studies professors. Like, he really revolutionized cinema and brought about like a new kind of punk rock aesthetic. His films are unflinching, and they're certainly, I've definitely put on Bruce LaBruce movies with groups of friends and not sufficiently prepared people there, and people have been very shocked by what they've seen. But he is certainly a true unique voice within film and within art in general. But before all that, he was a truly unique, important voice in making zines and in producing punk culture, because Bruce LaBruce, along with GB Jones and everyone from Fifth Column, were part of this really vibrant, very little scene in Toronto of queer feminist punk zine makers, punk people. And they put out this breadth of these incredible zines. Now I've got like actually quite a few at this point, but nothing close to all the stuff that was being put out there. And these things are amazing and totally cool design, but also the content in there, essays and reviews. And they were basically creating their own vision of what punk culture should be. And now that was eventually coined queercore. Eventually, a lot of the stuff that they were doing was picked up by the people that would be, you know, foundational in forming Riot Girl and doing zines like Girl Germs and Bikini Kill and Riot Girl fanzine and all that kind of stuff. So this it's a really important scene. So this is someone who not only is a legendary filmmaker, but also an incredibly important voice within punk rock. So as you can see, I'm a little bit excited about this episode. So I'm not going to yammer on too much longer, but I do want to say, check out the film She Said Boom by Kevin Heggie, a really cool person, a friend of mine from Toronto and an incredible filmmaker. He made this documentary, The Story of Fifth Column, and it is required viewing. It is kind of hard to track down. I was trying to find an easy place for you to view it now, but I think, yeah, it looks like you could probably order it somehow. If it ever plays near you, go and see this thing, because they are a band, as we talk about here with Bruce LaBruce, that is so important, so underdocumented, so underrated. Every time I get an opportunity to kind of do a list of essential Toronto records and bands, they're always on this list without fail. So Kevin's documentary is mandatory viewing. Also, I want to give a huge shout out and thank you to Derek, my manager at Review Video years ago, who was Bruce LaBruce's old roommate. He comes up on the podcast you're about to hear in a second. He also famously gave No Skin Off My Ass to Kurt Cobain when Nirvana played Lee's Palace, and Kurt Cobain was a huge fan of Bruce LaBruce forever after getting that video. Anyway, so huge thank you to Derek. Derek turned me on to a lot of cool music and a lot of cool culture, and I thank you to him for that. Also, definitely check out Bruce's latest film, Saint Narcisse. It's doing the festival circuit right now. Came out last year. Check out all his movies. He has done, I think this is his 13th full-length film. Anyway, an incredible filmmaker, an incredible conversation. I'm not going to blab anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Bruce LaBruce on Turned Out a Punk. Bruce, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I feel like this has been decades in the making. I have wanted to interview you for a very long time. So as I assured you before, this won't be too much of a punishment, I hope, but I do say that with an asterisk.
Lay it on me. Give me your best shot.
Okay. Well, I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Bruce, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah, that's going back a ways. I remember like more getting interested in it through the style than the music almost to begin with. Like, I remember when I was very young visiting Toronto, I lived on a farm and my sister, older sister, lived here in Toronto, and I would come to visit her. She was at university. So I'd be, I don't know, like 17, 18. And I saw this punk walking down the street, like in the late 70s with like in Toronto with a huge mohawk, you know, or early 80s, I guess. And I was just like, it went right through me. I thought I'd never seen anything so fantastic in my life. And, you know, this complete, like an alien, just an outcast and a complete freak. So I was kind of hooked, but even then. And then when I started coming to, when I came to Toronto to go to university myself, I was already in the 80s, like really like shaving my head and getting into mohawks and dressing punk. And then I met, it all started at this restaurant in Toronto called Just Desserts, which was a 24-hour restaurant where rich people went to eat cake after they left the bars, right?
Yes.
And the owner was this like ex kind of frustrated artist, ex art student who hired total like freaks, like just junkies and punks and film students. There was like, I went to York University and there was about seven or eight film students who were working there, and musicians and anarchists and just, you know, a ragtag bunch of people. And there was a band, members of a band working there called Fifth Column, who were, which was a Canadian kind of feminist punk band. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, not traditionally feminist, but, and GB Jones was a member, and I ended up moving in with them. And I remember, you know, that's where I first encountered Maximum Rock and Roll and got into the music. And first, I, you know, just going to bands, and I partied backstage with like Husker Du at Larry's Hideaway, and like the show they had in I guess it was like 80, I don't know, it must have been 89 or something. And I saw, you know, so many punk bands. There was great dedicated like hardcore venues in Toronto, like the Cocktail and the Siboney and Ildico's and a bunch of others. And there was like everything. There was like New Wave at Nuts and Bolts and at the I don't know, there were so many. And so I saw so many bands, and I even was like, you know, interviewing them for fanzines. I interviewed the Crucifix and Dave Dichter stayed with us one night when he was in town from MDC, and he's in some of my early Super 8 movies. And so yeah, that was it. It was this girl band that basically kind of that got me into it. I was their go-go dancer. So it was like reversing the sex roles, right? I was the object. I was the sexual object. But we opened for like Jesus and Mary Chain at the Masonic Temple, and like, I don't know who else. So it was fun.
I guess going back before you moved to Toronto, you know, you said you mentioned shaving your head and kind of styling your hair in a mohawk. What kind of music were you into prior to getting here?
When I was a teenager, I was into, you know, I was into like Elton John and David Bowie and kind of, you know, and Mark Bolan and all that kind of stuff. But in fact, my high school, there was a lot of really hot straight guys who were totally like glam rockers with the platform shoes, and they were really hot. And I don't know why, but I lived in a small town on Lake Huron that Port Elgin and Southampton, it was interesting because there was a nuclear power plant built nearby. And so a whole bunch of city kids moved to the area with their, you know, parents who were working at the, you know, engineers at the plant and all that stuff. So it was, and it was also a resort kind of town. So tourists from Michigan would come. Anyway, it ended up being, there was a surprising number of freaks, like, and a lot of drugs. And when I was growing up, but I also was I was totally into disco as well. I was into Blondie and, but also like classic disco. And I never really bought the, you know, the punk disco rift, you know. It's like, I was like, why can't I have both? And what else? I was actually into folk music too. Like I was into, you know, of course, Joni Mitchell was one of my idols. And even like, I don't know, Judy Collins and Neil Young, of course. And so, yeah, it was a bit eclectic actually.
Where were you kind of discovering music back then? Was it like, because, you know, it's all over the map. Was it through radio or is it through magazines? Like, where are you kind of picking up on all this stuff from?
I was also really into Motown, huge Stevie Wonder fan. The first albums I ever bought were like Joni Mitchell, Courtney Spark, Talking Book by Stevie Wonder, and the soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar, you know?
So, that's a mix.
Yeah. But I had a little transistor radio even when I was in early high school, that I would tune in when I was waiting for the school bus because I was on a farm. You'd wait forever. And I would listen to CKLW out of Detroit, which played all the Motown music. before I went to school. And then it was albums. I mean, you know, it was, there was one record store in the town, and I was kind of friendly with the guy that worked there. And, you know, I remember, for example, buying like the Hissing of Summer Lawns when it came out. It was just like, it changed my life. It was insane.
So when you get to Toronto, you know, you mentioned Fifth Column, and they're such a, they're such an underrated band. Like obviously Kevin Heggie's film, and they got that Polaris nomination a couple of years ago. But, you know, even with that, like for how significant that band is, you know, from yourself to the influence they had on, you know, obviously all the Riot Girl stuff, it's just like, it's like we have a real problem with canonizing cool culture in Canada.
Well, you know, NGB Jones and I started JDs together,
which
kind of kickstarted the queercore movement, which is still, I'm amazed at. I mean, there was a documentary about it recently, but and a book coming out based on the documentary, but you know, I'm amazed at how that movement has really kind of endured, and people are, you know, kids are still interested in it, and you know, I guess it's kind of still exists as a movement. Although Gucci put out a line of queercore shoes and boots recently, which I just made an offhand comment about it on Twitter, and the next day I got like an email from like one of the top people at Gucci apologizing, and I was like, "Oh no, it's okay, don't worry." I just didn't actually think the product matched what queercore was, you know. I didn't mind them appropriating it so much, because my whole life has been about appropriating other people's, well, stealing, you know, from other people. So, I mean, Fifth Column, it's, you know, it's too bad they weren't more prolific in a way. I mean, they just had the two albums. But they were definitely a more, you know, one of the more interesting bands that they were their references were very, you know, super interesting. They did a cover of like Nothing Can Change the Shape of Things to Come from Wild in the Streets, you know, and like Yesterday's Heroes. And I don't know, they were, they definitely had a more kind of intellectual and political angle to their music. But, you know, I mean, GB Jones has become, you know, a well-known artist, and we were included in the punk book that came out in Toronto, the hardcore book, a couple years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because it's, you know, like, you know, from the early years where they're affiliated with like really Red out of Texas to like later on where it's bands like, you know, Bikini Kill and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, this is the band that kind of spans the early years of punk from the very beginning of hardcore to like where it was kind of going post Nirvana explosion.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and then, you know, that really, I mean, I became friends with Lynn McNeil, who's the manager of Lee's Palace. And so I got into all the shows, but I saw like, you know, Nirvana when there was before Nevermind broke, and it was like there was like 40 people at the show, you know, and I saw the Screaming Trees there and the Wipers, and I mean, oh my god,
the Wipers yeah. Play Toronto.
I don't know, maybe it was in Toronto.
Oh wow, yeah, because I had no idea, but I that's one of my favorite bands ever.
Well, maybe they didn't play Toronto, but I did see them somewhere.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's awesome. I love them. So you, and also you mentioned JDs, which, you know, I'm flipped through. I only have a few of the issues, but, you know, just like, it's such an incredible zine. Like, and it really, like Toronto, it, like zines were the output, like zines and tapes, you know, like bands weren't prolific in putting out these LPs or 7-inches, but like just the beautiful zines that were coming out. And of course, like amazing tapes, like it really feels like that stuff, unfortunately, doesn't have the permanence that a record has, but the things that survive are just, you know, such amazing artifacts.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you know, zines were meant to be ephemeral, you know, not to last on a certain level. I have to laugh. My Anita Smith, who was in Fifth Column, she made a zine. I can't remember what it was called now. She made kind of a dyke zine that, and she deliberately like stapled it so that the pages were all askew, so it literally would not stay on the shelf in a store. it would have to fall off the shelf. So you'd go to the zine section and it'd be always on the floor, which I love. But but then when I started getting into making, you know, the movies that I started making were kind of an extension of JD's, the fanzine. And then I started using all the great, you know, a lot of great punk music for the movies. So, I mean, in No Skin Off My Ass, I mean, I used the soundtrack totally without permission. It was like, you know, Beefeater, like Danny's song, the Skinhead, Boys Just Turn Me On. And like the Nip Drivers, you know, their cover of Have You Ever Been Mellow and their song Quentin Crisp. And Frightwig, Mean Teen Queen. And so I was using it all in the movies. And, you know, it just became like a kind of a, what we did with JD's, we would kind of identify whatever we thought was like gay, not literally gay, but kind of like either you could tell there was maybe a gay member in the band, or there was a like homosexual subtext to the music, or and so that's what we were kind of identifying. And we made our JD's top 10 tape, which included, you know, people like, or songs like Patti Smith's Redondo Beach and like the Ramones 50,
53rd and Third?
53rd and Third, which is about Joey Ramone. Not Joey, but...
Dee Dee, right?
Dee Dee, Turning Tricks, right. So, yeah, it was kind of, we were kind of like queering everything. That was our original strategy, was to queer stuff that wasn't necessarily gay or homo or queer, whatever, but we sense a queerness in it and kind of exaggerate it, or, and of course, we'd juxtapose images of like naked Iggy Pop or naked David Cassidy with like gay porn, you know, images of gay porn. And that was our shtick, you know.
That's what I love so much about it. Like JD's, like the whole thing, like you mentioned that tape too. It's just like these top 10 lists when you have the Hit Parade or the top 20, it's just the taste were so all over the map, but it's like you're reclaiming stuff. Like even like a band like Aaron Disgrace, where you're reclaiming their song.
Right.
And it's just, there's something so, I don't know. It's like almost like French New Wave about it.
Faggot in the Family, or like, or, you know, Mighty Sphincter, Gay Bar. I mean, they're very ambivalent about homosexuality, but we would include them anyway, because I mean, we were ambivalent about it as well. So, I mean, and we were, you know, we were also rejecting the mainstream kind of gay culture. So, so for us, you know, the punk, being punk kind of took precedent over the idea of, you know, gay culture. But G.B. Jones and I shared a love of both classical Hollywood movies and Warhol's Factory, which wasn't so trendy at the time. And so we juxtaposed a lot of stuff that necessarily shouldn't go together, you know.
Well, it's funny because, like, yeah, the stuff that you're juxtaposing, like, it just recontextualizes so much, right? Like, you're mentioning even, like, naked Iggy Pop photos or, you know, just all these things where, you know, it's the ultimate punk thing to do, right? To, like, invent your own aesthetic and language using found culture.
Sure. And, I mean, the 70s, I mean, glam rock really flirted with, you know, and certainly androgyny and kind of, like, pansexuality and cross-dressing and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't much of a stretch. I mean, it's kind of latent in all, like, in a lot of rock and roll. And I mean, you know, Little Richard and what have you.
Well, and especially punk, right? Like going back to like the origins of it with like bands like the Mumps or Jane County, like there's just like such, you know, like sure. punk music or, is.
Yeah. Or, you know, like Darby Crash and the SoCal, you know, punk scene was particularly queer. And then, of course, you know, we became great comrades with Vaginal Davis, who was totally in the SoCal punk scene and knew everybody. And actually Pat Loud just died the other day, and she was saying how Lance Loud, speaking of the Mumps, you know, she would go over during that whole period of SoCal punk, and Pat Loud would have you know, the punks over and cook for them at Lance's, at her house on Fountain.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was really strong there. And Vaginal had her fanzine, Fertile LaToya Jackson. And we started corresponding with her, and I'd write her long rambling letters back and forth. And so when I first went to LA, which was when I showed Musk Enough Mass, like 1991, I stayed with her, and I just thought she was the most glamorous, amazing creature I'd ever seen in my life. And she was actually working at UCLA, and she'd be gone during the day, and she had this crummy apartment at the corner of Fountain and Sunset, Fairfax and Sunset. And I would be there, and like her phone would go off, and the answering machine would come off, and it'd be like, "This is Liz Rosenberg calling for Madonna. And I really want to speak to Miss Davis about doing something. And I'd get home and tell her, and she'd go, "Oh, I'm not talking to her. She just steals everything from everybody."
So you mentioned that kind of like network that begins forming at a certain point. Like when did you first start finding out about other people out there? Like, you know, kind of, you know, like out punk, you know, and things like other zines, other gay fanzines and queer fanzines that were kind of popping up all around, you know, North America around that.
Well, we encouraged people, like, you know, that was our whole thing. We encouraged people who might've been isolated in smaller cities and stuff, who were also queer, but more punk and didn't have any, you know, solidarity or didn't have any support with other people. And so we encouraged them to send us their tapes of their music and stuff. And then that was what we did. And then finally it became kind of like, you know, the whole story about how we pretended that that there was a full, in our fanzine, that there was a full blown like queer punk movement happening in Toronto. When there's actually just like three of us, and to the point where it was kind of, I mean, now it's kind of like it's kind of a questionable strategy because of fake news and everything like that. But it actually worked. I mean, it was like, because then bands started forming, fanzines started forming. I would like Homo Core magazine came out of San Francisco was totally influenced by us. I mean, so, you know, we were kind of acknowledged as sort of one of the first queer club fanzines. It was really us and Miss Davis in LA. And then at the same time, Linda Simpson, a drag queen in New York, was doing a magazine called My Comrade. And Jack Pearson, the artist, was doing most of the photography. And so there was a kind of parallel drag movement mm-hmm. that had like crossover with punk. And but you know, that was part of the process of the magazines. I mean, we would advertise and we would submit our fanzine for review to like the big four or five fanzines, which were Maximum Rock and Roll, Flipside, Forced Exposure, Factsheet 5, did I say that? And they would review us. Sometimes they'd like, they were homophobic or they were dismissive, and sometimes they were like, "This is really cool." And then we would do the same. We would review. People would send us our fanzines when we got a little more high profile, and we would review their fanzines in our fanzines. And then actually, it's so funny. I was thinking because when, you know, even before I made my first feature film, which was No Skin Off Mass, I went to New York with a friend and we went to see a band called, well, it was Michael Board, who was one of the writers for Maximum Rock and Roll, columnists. He had
was
a band
it Artless, maybe?
Yeah, he had a band called Artless, but no, it was his friends, it was friends of his who had a band. And so we went to see them at CBGB's. And when they saw me on the street, they were standing outside, they saw me on the street. And it was like, they were starstruck. And I was like, oh my fucking God. It's like, you know, I'd done nothing. I just like made this fanzine and they were actually starstruck.
It's so funny because like when I first got into punk rock, like I remember one of the things I heard is like, oh, Bruce LaBruce isn't the Bruce LaBruce that was the writer. It's an actor who's playing him that he got to replace him, like totally a JT LaRoy type thing. But
I encourage that. I mean, that was part of, I mean, we were also, you know, because we knew about the Warhol factory, we were, you know, Warhol had, who was the guy that Warhol sent out to imitate him on the lecture circuit? Alan Midget. Yeah. So he'd done it. And that was part of the factory gig. We were kind of a cross between situationists and the factory. So, you know, Vivo was one of our favorite Warhol superstars, and she used to write her own reviews and, you know, and write herself glowing reviews and publish them under different names, and which actually Trump did as well.
Yeah.
He had an alter ego that he wrote under the name of and promoted himself. But so, but it's funny because, you know, it's not funny, but it's weird that that the conservatives, the right wingers, the extreme right wingers have appropriated a lot of the strategies that we used back then, you know, and they're the politically correct ones, incorrect ones now. And they're the ones that are, you know, they're just more, they just have in a weird way, they have a kind of punk kind of strategy, which is disturbing. But
well, I was going to say, I mean, when I cut you off, sorry about that. But I was going to say, Gavin McGinnis, like, look at that guy. Look what he's trying to do right now, where he's trying to claim punk. You know, like it's really weird. Like you said, they're trying to co-opt. You know, it's going to be amazing when they start doing, well, not amazing, terrifying, but when they start putting out fanzines just to go the extra mile at a certain point.
Well, you know, I used to pal around a lot with Gavin in New York and back in the Vice days, and I was writing for them. And I remember somebody was tagging along with us, a journalist who was writing for, it was either the Times or New York Magazine or something. And she was writing a piece on Gavin. And at the time I used to wear NRA jacket, like a little NRA, National Rifle Association windbreaker. But for me, it was a punk thing. You know,
yeah,
it was like it was a cute little, you know, stylish little windbreaker, you know. And it was one of my favorite little pieces of fashion. So but that was in the spirit of punk, you know, which was like the swastikas and the and whatever, just, you know, wearing the trappings of your oppressor, you know, to take the piss out of it or to be ambivalent or to, you know, freak people out or for shock value or whatever.
Like those JD and, top 10 lists we were talking about earlier, same sort of, you know, thing, like the punk sort of tradition of that.
Yeah, but it was all about the political correctness and the ambivalence of everything, you know, and also using these signifiers as kind of assaultive, kind of like provocative gestures without explaining them to people, you know, they had to draw their own conclusions. So anyway, she nailed me in the article and she said, oh, you know, and his little friend was tagging along the queer fanzine editor, Bruce LaBruce or whatever, filmmaker, ironically wearing his little, you know, NRA jacket. And I was like, bitch, no, but she did kind of nail me. But I mean, at that time it had a totally different meaning. And of course, you know, punk meant something completely different then. So,
Well, so je ne regrette rien.
Well, it's funny. Well, you bring up Vice there, and it's interesting to think about Vice as being this thing that totally came out of the influence of, you know, the zines that you guys are doing here in Toronto, out of Answer Me fanzine, out of the stuff that's going on in New York with Ego Trip fanzine. Like, they basically just took all these zines and made an amalgam of them and stripped all the politics away. Well, with the exception of Answer Me, unfortunately. And
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Answer Me.
Answer Me was the one where he did the fourth issue that was, I'm not obviously supporting this, but it was Let's Hear It for Violence Against Women. And it was a huge freedom of speech issue.
Oh my God.
Jim Goey, well, wrote the Redneck Manifesto too.
I did it first. I mean, my friend Candy and I had a fanzine called Dumb Bitch Deserves to Die.
Yes.
DBDDT. I guess it must have been in the early 90s. And what it was we were always like, would see movies, horror movies or whatever, in which the line would come up like, oh, that dumb bitch, she deserved to die, you know? And so we put ourselves in the kind of persona of these guys that wrote these horror fanzines who were horribly sexist and misogynist. And we really inhabited these personas if we were actually writing these reviews. I mean, the cover of the fanzine had Karen Carpenter and Leanna Quigley, who was a horror scream queen. And the headline was From Cones to Bones. So because the cones were like Leanna Quigley's big breasts and the bones was Karen Carpenter because she had anorexia.
Holy.
We really inhabited how they wrote and their style. And then we passed it off as a real fanzine.
Were there two issues of that?
Or just one.
Just the one. Okay. Cause
but it's very dense.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
I haven't read it in years. I'm kind of afraid to read it.
Well, that's the other thing is like, also, I just was flipping through Fist in Your Face zine and you have that.
Oh, that was Candy.
Yeah. But you have that harrowing essay in it about being attacked by a friend who's a skinhead.
Oh yeah. That's my boyfriend. Yeah.
Wow.
He was my ex-boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was an interesting story. And that was in kind of, you know, what was, that's the story of punk in Toronto as well. I mean, you know, the punks and skinheads all started hanging out at the same venues because they were really basically listening to the same music, kind of thrash music. So it was not uncommon for them to be like neo-Nazis and stuff at these venues and at these shows. And you know, this guy that I started going out with, he was a hustler to begin with. This was in the mid 80s, and would hang out at gay bars, but he was straight, but he was gay for pay. And he was so good looking. He was like a young Robert De Niro crossed with like a young Morrissey or something. And he, so when I met him, he was kind of two-tone or something. He was like kind of rude boyish, kind of like, and he listened to like Billy Bragg and I don't know, like James White and the Blacks. We were kind of boyfriends, but he always had girlfriends. And then anyway, I didn't see him for a year or two. And then the next time I saw him, he had transmogrified into a neo-Nazi skinhead. And I was still like freaked out. But he was homeless. And so I invited him into my house to stay, like for old time's sake. And I was trying to joke him out of, or I couldn't believe he was serious about being like, you know, neo-Nazi. So I was kind of trying to humiliate him or embarrass him about it. And one day he just beat the shit out of me. So I didn't see him again, but.
It's so fucked
later,
up.
He ended up getting AIDS, and he used to turn tricks in a wheelchair out of the oak leaf.
Holy my God. It's like you brought it up, but like, I remember just kind of becoming cognizant of what was going on in the news at the time that there was like, you know, it was like skinhead, like terror had swept Toronto, like skinheads and the Untouchables gang.
But it seemed to me that like, they disappeared almost overnight. I mean, it was almost as if the punk scene, I don't know about this, but it was almost as if the punk scene just kind of got sick of them and kind of just didn't tolerate them anymore because they kind of disappeared.
Yeah, it's actually kind of like a weird theme that's come up several times on the show, but there's almost seems like it's the BFGs at a certain point fighting them across Canada, because like with the people from Propagandhi came on the show and have talked about how they had a Nazi problem from all these Nazis from Toronto showing up. And then the BFGs came there on tour and beat up all the Nazis and they moved to Vancouver. And then someone came on from Vancouver and talked about the Toronto Nazis showing up there. And it just feels like you're saying, like they eventually got like by force driven out of the scene.
Yeah. It seemed like it, but the BFGs were, yeah, maybe the BFGs were largely responsible. I used to go to their speakeasy from time to time in the market. And, but actually when I lived at Queen and Parliament with Fifth Column, and Candy lived next door with Sue, who was Godzilla's girlfriend from the BFG. And so, and they were a bit homophobic, some of them at that time. Yeah. So I would sometimes have to ride the streetcar with Godzilla, and he kind of begrudgingly let me sit down beside him, but I was kind of terrified of him.
Well, you actually bring it up in that essay that you wrote in Fist in Your Face that, you know, even the fact that someone was like a sharp, you know, an anti-racial prejudice doesn't mean that they weren't still an asshole and homophobic.
Right. Exactly.
It really feels like also at that time in Toronto that like it was fairly violent. Like there were, you know, like that Fist in Your Face fanzine's three issues of just people being beaten up.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure it still happened, but I mean, the punk scene was very edgy and there was this clash between extreme right and extreme left. And, you know, there was a lot more stuff going on then. There was so many speakeasies. I mean, there was hundreds of speakeasies. And and you'd see fights at speakeasies all the time, you know, but that's because it was after hours. People were getting drunk and drinking and doing drugs. And there was no like authorities around and no like, you know, no bouncers or anything. So it was just like, it just happened. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that was when Toronto was glamorous. You know?
Yeah, exactly. It's also amazing, like how many people are coming out of that punk scene that wind up doing like interesting things in the world of art or in the world of music, or like, you know, just like for how small it probably was at those shows. Like it seems like there were a lot of really creative people drawn to it.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, fanzines were particularly conducive to being like multidisciplinary, because we did like everything. We wrote stories, we did comics, we did photography, we did collage, we did the desktop printing, basically, you know, do it yourself kind of layout and cut and paste and Xerox art and, you know, just everything. So, and then we started making the films as well. So it was really a kind of great, creative, soup, you know.
Remember the first concert you went to, like actually period concert wise?
You know, I think Lisa Del Bello played at our high school. it was so funny because she had enormous breasts, and all the grade 9 boys were like just right at the front, like just with their tongues hanging out. And I saw Teenage Head really early on.
Really?
Oh yeah. I saw great. I mean, I used to go to the CNE in the summer when I was like 15, 14, 15, 16. I saw the Beach Boys twice.
Oh, that's awesome.
I saw the Stampeders, Guess Who. Yeah. I love Canadian rock.
Really? I would never have thought that, actually, to be honest with you.
Oh, Guess Who? My God.
So when you saw Teenage Head there, was that the infamous riot show?
No, I didn't see them in Toronto. I saw them in like Own Sound or something.
Oh, that's awesome. They are, you know, it's funny because like they're going before the Ramones, you know, like they yeah. really are the original punk band.
Yeah, they're very kind of Ramonesy. I mean, he has that great voice too.
Oh yeah, an incredible voice. And like, it's funny, like, you know, I'll still be in the car with, you know, the kids taking them somewhere and they'll be Teenage Head come on the radio. So they still get that radio play in Canada. That's that can rock, you know, it shines through.
Yeah. No, there was great. I mean, there was some other like really, really weird, obscure. Oh, I saw like, I guess I saw who did Roxy Roller. Oh, I can't remember now.
You stumped me on that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah. But I use that song, Roxy Roller. Foxy from the Roxy might turn some heads tonight. Flashlight Dream, Peaches and Cream Delight, Roxy Roller.
So when you got to York.
Oh, and of course, Rough Trade, my God.
Oh, incredible band. Like,
huge influence on me. I mean, like, High School Confidential came out when I was like in high school, I think. And it was, you know, you know, just the open lesbian lyrics of that song are incredible. So it was a combination, Anita Ekberg, Mamie Van Doren, Dagmar. And then she goes, she drives a candy pink Cadillac. If I don't have her soon, I'll have a heart attack. I mean, yeah, it was a huge. And then I didn't finally see Rough Trade until much later. So it was kind of towards the end before they, when they were still together, like maybe one of their later albums. What was the one, For Those Who Think Young,
because is that the one that came out like the late 80s?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's when I met her, and then but now we're friends.
That's awesome.
I run into her at people's dinner parties and stuff.
I remember she played a Vaseline years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, then there's the next chapter. I mean, that's then Will Monroe came along and he really spearheaded everything. I mean, he had every great queer band. Mm-hmm. And performer that you could think of. I mean, that was a real amazing chapter, and that really brought together this, you know, the skinheads and the punks, the straight punks and the queers. You know, that was because that crowd was queer, but not necessarily homo. I mean, you know, it's like there was a lot of crossover. Yeah.
It really felt like that was the JD's scene sort of brought into the real world in a lot of ways. Like the stuff he was playing, even like it felt like it was that same sort of philosophy, but brought into like a physical space.
That's it. I mean, I never really thought about it that way, but what we created fictionally, he kind of like realized in the real world. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he was such, you're like, well, you know, obviously he's a friend of yours, but he was like, he used to come in a suspect and we just sit there and talk about you. Like he was, like so influenced by you.
Well, I used to drop in on him when he worked at the Midtown Cafe. Mm-hmm. on College.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a bunch of cute boys working there, and I used to drop in and have a coffee and stare at them.
It's also, I guess.
And then I worked for years at Barfi's, the Hacienda, and that was a whole other amazing chapter where everyone who was anyone would come into the La Hacienda to because it was owned by, you know, two guys in bands, and that was another whole interesting fun chapter.
Well, I kind of wanted to get like, what was Toronto like when you got, you know, when you're at York and kind of,
oh my God, it was so glamorous. I mean, you know, you had these all-night restaurants like the Bloor Street Diner, and you had these really kind of new wave shishi restaurants like the Fiesta and the Metropolitan, and I mean the Queen Mother and the Peter Pan too were started. Mm-hmm. And they're still around, but that was kind of a nexus where and there was the Roselle Cafe, and
there was kind of a circuit almost where all the cool people would work between those restaurants, and including Just Desserts. There was kind of people would get sick of working at one place and they go work at another one. So there was that aspect, but then there was the clubs that were amazing, like Pariah and Voodoo Club and the Twilight Zone and what else? I mean, there's so many. And there were kind of after hours clubs where they didn't really. I saw the Gun Club at like after hours at the, I guess it was the at Pariah, I think.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Do they play like a regular show or they just come to town and play an after hours club?
I think it was kind of like an unbilled show or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
What about local bands? Like, you know, obviously you're in Fifth Column after a certain point, but like, what were some of the other local bands that you remember other than like the BFGs?
Oh, Sudden Impact and Hype. Let's see. Well, Dayglo Abortions were West Coast, I guess, and DOA. I mean, I saw NSFU all the time playing in Toronto. But local bands, I don't know. There was bands like Woods Are Full of Cuckoos and well, you probably know better than I.
No, I know. I just like, because I'm fascinated by, you know, like there's almost like so few documents of all these bands that exist, right? Like, so every time I'm like get a chance to talk to someone, I'm like, oh yeah, what else was there? Because, you know, as we were talking about, it's flyers and fanzines which have this ephemeral quality and then they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, those I don't have, my memory isn't quite as because they were, I guess, so kind of ephemeral. I don't really remember them so much. I'd have to give it a think.
What about Zuzu Pedals? Like, you played drums in that band, right?
Zuzu Pedals was like a joke band, really. I mean, we were just like fucking around. I mean, it was fun. I mean, it was super fun, but it was just kind of a hobby. I mean, I was playing the drums. I had no rhythm. But that's what you could do in punk, you know. But
yeah,
but we were more like a funny punk band, which. I mean, Rod the singer was amazing. I mean, we did funny things. Like he did a cover of "By the Time I Get to Phoenix" in a Scottish brogue. You know, yeah, it was just fun. We did Partridge Family covers, One Night Stand.
I think you do a Dick Kennedy's cover too, right?
A what?
A Dick Kennedy's cover. I think you do Nazi Punk's "Fuck Off," maybe.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. And that's, you know, that was one of the times I got, you know, punched in the nose by this British guy was with a huge mohawk. We were opening for some band at the Cocktail, and I was mincing around, and he punched me in the nose, blood flowing Holy everywhere. Shit. Yeah.
Like, you know, you say it still happens, and obviously there's still tons of violence today, but like it just feels like none of that shit really flies, especially in the current punk scene. Like, I just couldn't imagine.
Oh, no, that. No. No, I mean, I went to shows like that you really felt like you could, like, especially as a queer punk. And I used to, like, really dress kind of somewhat androgynously. I just would be wearing like black tights and a leather belt and, like, you know, high motorcycle boots and just really kind of pretty androgynous, and occasionally a skirt and it seemed dangerous. But then, you know, there was the political, you know, when it was more political, like during the what was it called? The Anarchist Unconvention. Yeah, the Anarchist Unconvention, which was in 1988, I think. And I went to the show. That's when Dave Dichter was stayed with overnight. It was the MDC, Scream, and Mr. T Experience.
What a bill. Holy.
at the Silver Dollar Room.
I've never heard about this show ever.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was during the 1988 Anarchist Unconvention, and NBC had been, you know, banned from Canada, and so they had to bring them on boats across a reservation, and they performed with bags over their heads.
Oh my god!
And Dick Dave, of course, was a big cross-dresser, so he was wearing. I wonder if Kurt Cobain stole his wearing dresses from Dave Dichter, because he did it really early on, I think. Yeah, and it was a great show, but it felt like it could be raided by the cops at any time, because they were playing this kind of illicit show. There's like this, the city was covered with anarchists from all over North America, and but that was like a real political kind of show, like, you know, super left. There would be no, and you know, there were pretty a lot more woke than like San Francisco, so there would be no like threat of violence or anything like that. But I mean, the mosh pits always got testy.
Well, like you're saying, it's almost like Toronto had just like extremes at that point in terms of punk rock, where you have, you know, like the fascist stuff that ultimately would be like Rahoa and Resistance Records kind of going on in one area, and then you have like the sound of like cool leftist punk scene on the other side.
Yeah, and then there's kind of an apolitical kind of dimension too sometimes, where it was just about the music and the style, you know, which is, I mean, but it was much more sincere and political, you know, than the British scene ever was, which was all hype and kind of like posturing and you know, kind of pretty cynical, you know, except for obvious bands like Crass or whatever, but.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even Crass, like it's amazing, you know, looking into their politics, it's such like a weirdly different type of politics. Like it's almost like, it's like true anarchism, where they want nothing to do with any political system.
Yes. But that was more like, you know, that's anarcho-syndicalism, which is more about complete decentralization of government and you know, everything is local and committees. And, you know, I totally hung out with a lot of anarchists and kind of was into some of those political ideas. But if you ever attended like an anarchist gathering, you know, it's part of the part of the paradox of complete democracy is that nothing ever gets done because everyone has had to say, you know. So, but you know, Toronto had its, you know, dedicated. I mean, when we were living at Queen and Parliament, when I was living there with Fifth Column and the Goose next door, you know, or Godzilla anyway, and Sue, it was a little kind of punk enclave there. And then there was the cathedrals, you know, on Christie, the anarchist households, Cathedral A and Cathedral B. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sri and their band was Discipline and Punish, and, you know, which is named after a Foucault book. And so, but we had some crossover, like we would hang out with them and somewhat. And I mean, we were different. We had different kind of like kind of outlooks and philosophies in a way, but because we weren't hardcore anarchists, we were more I would say radical left. I mean, I was at, you know, at the same time I was at York University and was studying with Robin Wood, who was like a hardcore anarchist Marxist, no, sorry, hardcore Marxist feminist gay film critic. And, you know, when I think about his politics and what he was teaching back then, it was just as out there and radical as what the punks were doing, if not more.
Yeah.
You know, because he had this Marxist enclave up there. You know, and he was totally at odds with the film production department, and I was kind of in between the two. And but they were like teaching really. He was really teaching like really, you know, anti, way before the woke, you know, the woke movement, anti-patriarchy and kind of, but, and, you know, he wrote a famous article called that came out as gay late in his career, and wrote an article called The Responsibility of the Gay Art Critic, and from a complete, you know, analyzing horror films from a Marxist perspective, mm-hmm. B-movies. And meanwhile, the other, and we, his kind of following was completely at odds with the semioticians and the French post-structuralists who were the other side of the academic scene at that time. And he hated post-structuralism. And so there was like, but the, and they were, you know, as it turned out, they were like pretty practically right wing. I mean, a lot of the semiotics. So.
I only met him because once again, working at the video stores, he'd come in and rent movies, but just, you know, as like, you know, taking film later on, you know, reading stuff that he had written or just buying DVDs from Criterion. He'd written the essay for the Hitchcock reissue or something. You know, it's very much the same sort of thing that you're doing, where he's like recontextualizing all this stuff and like certainly finding like political sides to things that didn't necessarily have overt political angles on first blush, you know, like it really feels like, and I don't mean to put this on you if this isn't the case, but that would have been an influence on what you would do a little later on.
Oh, for sure. But you mean Robin?
Yeah, Robin.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, when I was, we started this magazine called Cine Action, and I was on the original editorial collective, but I was the one that was writing about, they were really focused on mainstream Hollywood cinema, doing a radical analysis of that cinema and a Marxist kind of, and, you know, he was famous for the queer sub, the homosexual subtext of like class of Howard Hawks and all that kind of stuff. And, but I was bringing in, like, I was writing about Warhol films. I was writing about the experimental downtown video scene, you know, for that magazine. So I was kind of coming at it from a kind of more underground perspective, but, you know, in retrospect, I mean, both kind of parts, both of those, kind of political interventions were pretty radical. I think I was kind of, I think punk, like I've been deprogrammed and you know, unbrainwashed like several times in my life. And I think punk kind of like deprogrammed me somewhat from my more orthodox kind of, and very politically correct, Marxist feminist training. In fact, I had two friends in New York who sat me down one day and read me the Riot Act because I was being too politically correct. And that's when it kind of dawned on me that I was being closed-minded. And I mean, we wrote something really critical about Lydia Lunch and the cinema of transgression and Kemper Fowler I wrote an article called Pissing on the Cinema of Transgression. And these are all artists that I adore now, like, you know, Lydia Lunch and Kemper Fowler, and I'm really good friends with Kemper. But I was so, you know, I had a kind of feminist perspective that was extremely politically correct. We were kind of almost like SJWs at that point. And then I realized how ridiculous that was. And I, you know, it was a big revelation how feminist in, you know, how the feminism of like Lydia Lunch and Kemper Fowler was like, what was the kind of feminism that I was actually most interested in. And that was a big, and in my films, you know, I had been afraid to represent female sexuality in my films or any kind of sexuality that wasn't politically correct. And then I started, you know, making films with like gang bangs, you know, I completely blew everything open, you know, for myself. So, and that persists with me today. And I attribute that more to punk, even though the two people that sat me down and gave me that talk were not punks. They were in the underground kind of scene. in New York. But it's always good at a certain point in your life when you you have a good hard look at yourself and assess exactly what you're doing and question the basic principles of what you've learned and to kill your idols and question, you know. You know, to Robin Wood's credit, he always, his number one rule was always question authority, you know, including his own. So that was a good lesson.
Going back to that sentiment suggestion, it's funny you brought that up because I was just about to ask you, like, was that all at all informative on your work? Or is it something that, you, as you said, you were rejecting kind of outright at that point early on?
The thing is, I was always like a kind of contrarian. So I was kind of questioning the, I mean, in the same way that I questioned the radicalism of punks because they were homophobic, and you know, our point was, you can't be a revolutionary, you can't be a true political radical without being a sexual revolutionary and without accepting, like, you know, homosexuality. And so, in the same way, I was questioning their. The radicalism, but from a very, you know, it was a very politically correct, narrow kind of position. But I tended to, and still do to this day, just be a shit disturber and a contrarian. So if sometimes, you know, it's just a impulse. Like if someone says black, I'll say white. It's just, and that's, you know, and again, going back to Trump, this is like, this is a strategy that the radical right has appropriated, and so it's to the point where at this point I don't even tend to situate myself on the political spectrum. I mean, I just call myself a radical pragmatist.
You've gone full crass, just not on the anarchist side.
No, I don't know what it is. It's more about independent thinking and individualism. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I see now happening in the world and in the States, especially here is fascism on the right and Stalinism on the left. You know.
Well, it's like you brought
extreme,
up
at the extreme ends, you know.
Well, because you brought up earlier, like punk rock is always, I felt like a microcosm for what's going to happen in the future. You know, like you're looking back on the way, you know, punk politics go in terms of liberation politics, be it animal liberation or just all sorts of political things that kind of hit punk first and kind of were accepted into punk rock first before the rest of the world kind of takes notice.
But punk was amazing because it embraced so many different kind of crackpots and oddballs and yeah. Misfits. So you had like Hare Krishna straight edge, you know, Cro-Mags, you know, Hare Krishna straight edge kind of homophobes. And then you had like, and then you had Boyd Rice, you know, who was like this bizarre, I mean, Boyd Rice was actually a precursor to everything that's going on with like Gavin McGinnis and all this shit.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, he started out, I think, sort of posturing as this kind of like, almost like fascist character who was flirting with the extreme right, and it seemed like it started out as a posture, and then as it went along, it actually became what he believed, mm-hmm. And that's what happened with Vice too. I mean, yeah, I mean, Gavin went from a kind of leftist kind of belief system to an extreme right one. So.
Yeah. And I think it's always been about that, getting that attention, right? Like he was in a band called Anal Chinook. Like you're not calling yourself that if you're not wanting attention.
Yes. And I mean, you know, even his attitude towards, me and I mean, he thought I was a good gay because I was a bad gay, you know, but you know, he could, you know, I don't know, he would he was a character. I mean, I would go do naked karaoke with him in New York, and we had some good times. I mean, I haven't talked to him in years, but he wanted to have me on his show recently, a couple years ago, but I was just like, oh, he'll kind of like make mincemeat out of me. Just, you know, these days, I don't know. You can get into territory where there's a lot of things that I'm just keeping to myself these days.
And it's also, it's like you said, like, you know, they've developed, they've appropriated all the rhetoric and all the tactics from punk rock at this point. And the problem is it's not just rhetoric anymore. There's like a bunch of people that, you know, are not connected at all to this thing, that just hear what he's saying and are willing to die for it.
Yep. I mean, that's what insurrection is. I mean,
yeah.
So, yeah. You know, if the shoe was on the other foot, and if it was like leftists storming the Capitol building, I don't know how I would feel, you know? So, the problem is that the established left has now become the establishment, you know? I mean, the left center or whatever is like the ultimate establishment. So the tables have turned with a vengeance, you know? Mm. I don't know what the hell's going on down there. It's insane. All I hope is that they're fortifying the Canadian border, because we don't want to get to a Handmaid's Tale scenario, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's like, you look, it's, you know, terrifying, but you look at the fact that, like, be it Gavin or be it, you know, the Resistance record stuff in the 90s, like, a lot of that shit starts in Canada and then, you know, gets exported to America, where it really takes root.
Well, what's really scary is I found this out a couple of years ago, where I ran into this girl who's dating a friend of mine, and she was from some town, I don't know, like Barrie or wherever it was, Aurelia or something. And she said that her younger brother and all his friends in this town were riding around with Confederate flags. And, yeah, you know, and that was like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Or more, 4 years ago, maybe. So it's weird. I mean, you have to, you know, Canada better not get complacent, or else we're going to be overrun with it too. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have kept you for a long time, Bruce, and I have barely scratched the surface. At some point in the future, would you come back and do a part two with me?
Oh, sure.
But before I let you go, just because I've heard several different versions of the story over the years, I just wanted to get from yourself, how did I Want to Be a Homosexual come about?
Ah, yeah. Well, Ben, that was another thing. The story was, I don't know, the Screeching Weasel played... I think I first met them when they played in the market at, was it the Sibony? It was mm-hmm. in the market. Yeah. That's where I saw great concerts there. I saw the, Bjork's band, Sugar Cubes there. It was one of the best shows I ever seen. But, I saw Screeching Weasel there and met Ben, went back because we knew each other from the fanzines and stuff. And, who was it? The band that had the song I don't want to be a homosexual?
Sloppy Seconds.
Sloppy Seconds, yeah. So you know, and I think he was, I don't know if he was friends with them or he knew them, but so I just, because of that song, we were talking, and I just challenged him. I said, well, you know, if you're actually like not homophobic, why? I challenged him to write a song called I Want to Be Homosexual, and he was totally game. And up for it. I mean, I actually did a music video for them, which I shot down in Chicago once. And I went down and stayed with Ben for a week while I was shooting this. He actually got me into basketball at the time, because it was unbelievably, because I hate sports.
Yeah.
But it was at the height of Michael Jordan. And so we were watching the Bulls and bonding. I was bonding with straight guy, this gorgeous straight guy, straight punk. And I made this video and they hated it. Was it Lookout? Alternative Tentacles or Lookout?
Lookout
or,
Records, no, yeah.
Lookout.
they hated the video I did. It was totally sexist because I was making a point of like objectifying a woman in the video in an ironic kind of way, and they hated it. And in fact, that's when the editor on that video turned out to be the woman who was from LA. And when I went to LA to make Hustler White, she ended up being the editor. And if it wasn't for her, that film would never have been made. But anyway, so yeah, he made the song. And then I wrote the introduction. And I can't even remember where I recorded it. I think I just recorded it on a tape recorder and sent it to him.
Was that when you shot the stuff that's in Super 8.5 with Ben?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was on that same trip. I guess it was, or whether he came to Toronto twice. I can't remember. Because I would have shot that in 1992 when I lived at, I lived for 4 years at Bathurst and Richmond in a 3,000 square foot warehouse. We used to have some wild parties there, believe me.
The old Toronto, you know, where you could have a loft space like that.
We're like, well, there's three or four of us living there, but yeah.
And it's funny
because it actually became a punk venue for a while after that. It's right above it. It's out on that corner. Is it Adelaide or Richmond? It's like on the corner on the west side where there used to be a bike shop underneath it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like that actually got like, that's, it was passed from punk to punk.
Yeah. And I lived there. Derek lived there for a while.
My gosh.
And then about 10 years later, I went to a punk show. Somebody took me to a punk show there and the band was playing in my former bedroom.
Because I think actually that is where Tragedy played, and infamously the band They Live that opened for them, the lead singer was Blowing Fire, coughed, and it just lit the whole venue on fire. And oof. but they managed to put out the fire, and the cops showed up in the fire department, and somehow the show proceeded afterwards.
Sure. Wow.
Old Toronto.
Well, it was all wooden. The whole place was wooden.
Yeah. It would have killed us all.
When I was living there, there was a old printer underneath, and the fumes used to like be really bad coming down from this old printing press downstairs. Yeah. And there was a barber who was right beside there. What was his name? A Greek barber. And he was homophobic as fuck. So I couldn't even get my hair cut. Like.
Toronto.
Yeah.
I guess like the other thing I've also kind of always wanted to ask you about, and it's funny because I was talking to Danko Jones, wanted me to say hello, by the way, but I was talking to him about it the other day, and he said he didn't meet you until Danko Jones was already going as a band. Like, did you ever see the Violent Brothers or anything? His older band?
No.
So by that point, were you just like, was it because you were?
But I saw pretty early Danko shows. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that article that you wrote, and it was just like you said earlier on, it was almost like you were doing with JD's, where it was just like the article that you wrote was actively building that myth early on about Danko Jones, the band.
The article I wrote?
Yeah, you wrote an article. I think it was for Now, but it was Now, and it was like all about.
Well, no, I wrote something for one of the records, like for the sleeve.
This was actually like even pre that. Like it was like it was like a column super early on, like around the first 7-inch type thing.
I started hanging out with him through Gavin. Gavin, you know, the record producer, Gavin.
Oh, from Flight Camp.
Yeah, Gavin.
Gavin Brown.
But Gavin Brown, who became a big producer.
Yes,
But I worked at the Hacienda with Joy, the infamous Joy, and we hated each other. She used to work at Sneaky D's. She worked at Sneaky D's when it was on Bloor Street, and I would go in there, and we hated each other. And then we started working at the Hacienda together, and we ended up becoming best buds. And she started going out with Gavin, and then I met Rishi through Gavin.
Yeah. So that's like, it's amazing how small a world it is. Like how
everyone. Oh, right. Yeah. It was all interconnected back then, for sure.
Well, Bruce, as I said, this has been unbelievable and kind of a dream come true for me. And as I said before, anytime you want to come back on the show, please know the door is always open.
Sure. Yeah. Have me back. Maybe I'll try to give a think more about that.
Thank you, Bruce, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Bruce will be back for a part two at some point in the future. It'd be amazing to get him and Danko Jones back together for a reunion. You know, maybe we'll do that. Well, we got plans. We got plans. Speaking of plans, coming up in a few short days, I'm going to bust my little butt and get this up there for you, because this is a doozy. We are keeping that flame still burning around here at Turned Out of Punk. Now, that probably leads you to a lot of guesses about who the guest is going to be next week. And no, it's not that person. Actually, it is though someone I've wanted to have on this show for ever. Someone I'm a huge fan of. Someone I think is an unbelievable once-in-a-generation songwriter. Coming on the show next is Liz Phair. That's right, the legend, and this is an incredible conversation. Oh, I was stoked to get to do this, and I'm very, very excited you get to hear it. So that is coming up once again. I keep saying it because I want it to happen in a few short days. All right. Okay, well, that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids, and we need to help trans people protect themselves, and we need to stop the violence and hate and racism against Asian people as well. Go out there right now, get informed, read about what's happening in this world, donate your time, your money, your compassion, your heart to what's happening. Just try and have empathy for what people are dealing with right now, and stand up to Nazis. Fuck these Nazis. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for these organs, you don't need them anymore, and maybe someone else will be able to live with them. Make something creative. Put yourself out in this world. You don't have to show anyone. Just make a drawing just for yourself. Make your own little cartoon strip, you know, just for you. It helps. It'll help. Speaking of helping, I found meditation has helped me recently. You might want to try it. I'm not telling you what to do, but you might want to try it. Maybe it'll work. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. I didn't think it was going to work, and it worked for me. Wear a mask. Hopefully we're going to get through this. You know, I see a lot of bands now booking tours, and it doesn't seem like this time last year when bands were booking tours, just throwing stones into a well, hoping that they would eventually land. Like, now it feels like there might be an end in sight, but we still got to be smart. We still got to be safe. And that's what it's all about, just being safe. Listen to Oil and Flowers with Buddha Blaze and myself. We talk about cannabis and the cannabis news and goings-ons. And then that's it. That's it. Subscribe to this thing. Thanks for listening. I love you.